Okay, welcome to Discovery 1, Module 6. 6? Yes, 6. That's the one that's titled Network Services. Now, before we get started, has anybody got any pending questions, queries, worries? Tomorrow we are doing a network. We are doing a chat on netbooks. If you don't know what a netbook is, you'll have to turn up to tomorrow's chat and find out. They are the sub-notebook-sized laptop-y things that seem to be taking the world by storm. And that's all good. So has anybody got any questions, queries, and how's everybody finding the course so far? Are we still having fun? And I do have an announcement after we've checked up on that. Yes, Grace.
Okay, my question is kind of not class-related, but who's coming in? What time are we supposed to be online tonight? And all that good stuff. And is that even still happening? So, yeah.
It might not happen. This is a minister who might not decide to walk down this way in the building, and he may not even set foot in here. But it is 1:30 Perth time, which is, I believe, 11:30 your time, because you're 14 hours behind us, which makes it 1:30, so minus 3 is 9:30 Indian time, I think.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's 10:30. I think I screwed things up Sunday night. So, yeah, because it's 9 now. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's 9 now, so it would be in 4.5 hours' time.
Yep, that's 10:30. Okay.
So, yeah, if you happen to be around, that's good. We'll all jump on Ventrilo. But as I said, he might not even walk past. And they sort of do all these sort of wander around the building things and never actually come here, so we can't guarantee anything because he's a politician. Yes, Suman.
Yeah, good morning, Harry. And as we discussed about ports and lots of other stuff last class on Wednesday, so I just have a question, like, you know, are NAT filtering and firewall are the same thing?
No, they're not. And I'll cover that in a second because I just want to finish off this... organizational stuff. Now, what time is it over there, guys, in India? Just make my life a bit easier. What time is it at the moment? 5:30 in the morning, is it?
Oh, yeah, it is 5:30.
Yes.
Okay, for anybody who can be on Ventrilo, we need you guys here at 10 o'clock in the morning,
it's
your time. Now, I realise... Now, I realise some of you won't be able to and you'll be busy working, and in fact, if all of you can't, that's understandable, but we might be having a minister walk in. We don't know. So if you can't be there, it's not the end of the world. But if you can drop onto Ventrilo for 10 or 15, that would be really good. But don't sweat it if you can't make it.
So the federal minister or one of your brand new state ministers?
Yeah, brand new state minister. Still with the sticky tape and everything on.
Gotcha.
Okay. Now, Module 4. Everybody keeps asking me about Module 4. Who has read Module 4? Has anybody not read Module 4?
Not that they're going to admit to.
10 marks if you're not on it. 10 marks off your mark if you're not honest.
I read it, and that's how I knew that you don't necessarily... Well, I think the answers are pretty obvious if you read it.
Yeah, look, if you read Module 4, and this is one of the things I really want to stress. I'm always stressing about lots of things, but that's just me. These lectures are an adjunct to the notes. In other words, they are on top of the notes that you do have to read. You cannot get through this course purely by listening to these lectures. You can theoretically get through the course just by reading the notes and doing the exams. However, the lectures make things a bit more fun. So if you really want me to whiz over of this core layer and that sort of thing for Module 4, I can, although I did sort of cover it in a bit in the lecture the week before last. But if you have any specific questions about the content in Module 4, feel free to raise them. Otherwise, I will do a Module 4 lecture. I would have preferred to have spent 2 lectures on IP addressing and subnet masks like I have, rather than doing the Module 4 lecture. So has anybody got any questions on Module 4, or has everybody been waiting for a lecture on it?
No, I think I was pretty cool with it at the time. It's been a few weeks ago since I read it, actually.
Does anybody want a Module 4 lecture, or are we going to read it and see how we feel about it and then make a decision after that? Because I can do a Module 4 lecture, but basically it just talked about routers and switches and hubs and the things that you tended to have at an ISP, which I thought was all pretty straightforward and didn't require much explanation. And if it does require explanation, I really need to hear about it, because otherwise I'll assume that it doesn't. So if you don't want to own up on chat or whatever, email me privately afterwards and let me know if there's going to be, if you do really want a Module 4 lecture. Yep. No worries. So you guys have a look through Module 4 and see how you think about, see how you guys feel about it. I would have thought that you guys would have pre-read it already, because I was theoretically going to have done a Module 4 lecture rather than actually listening to my lecture and read it. I don't know which order you guys do it, but I tend to encourage people to pre-read the material and then listen to the lecture. The lecture tends to make more sense once we've done that, and you get this wonderful feeling of deja vu. Okay, now Suman has raised a question. Is a firewall and a NAT the same thing? No, they're not. A firewall is obviously something that is supposed to stop and prevent packets from getting into your network. And NAT is something that allows you to share one publicly routable IP address. Out of morbid curiosity, did you go and have a look on VoIP-info.org, Suman? Because I know you're battling with VoIP at the moment.
Yes, I admit. Not completely, but you know, I have glanced over the site.
No, that's fine. And my other brief question for you is, what are you using as your telephone instruments? Are you using a soft phone, or are you using actual VoIP phones, or are you using an analog telephone adapter? And if so, which one?
I'm using my mobile phone, Nokia E65, as my VoIP device, because that has VoIP features in it, and I'm using soft phone Express Talk from NCH Solutions.
Okay, I can solve one of your problems right now. Express Talk from NCH Solution is broken and will not work properly on a machine with more than one network interface. So I can solve that problem for you right now. Go get SJ Phone, which does work.
SJ Phone. Oh, is it accessible to JAWS, sir?
It's not as good as Express Talk, but it is accessible as far as accessibility is concerned. But Express Talk does break horribly on computers that have more than one network interface. And if you have installed VMware Server or you have more than one network interface, it will bind to the wrong one and your VoIP will be broken.
Okay, so I will try using SJ Phone today, sir. And sir, my question was firewall and NAT filtering, because when I go through my router's configuration page, it says that NAT filtering on and off.
I'm not sure what they're actually referring to by NAT filtering. You would actually have to refer to your router's manual to figure out in which way they are using the terminology. NAT does create, and they call it a natural firewall, NAT. Isn't that sad, but it's marketing jingo. And what happens is that when you are translating between your internal private IP addresses and your public routable IP address, the packets can come out and the return packets for the connection can come back, but intruders can't get into your network easily, which is why they call it a natural firewall. So you're going to have to look up the router manual for your router and find out what they mean by NAT filtering. In fact, what happens when NAT filtering is enabled as opposed to what happens when route filtering is disabled. If you want VoIP working behind your network address translating router, take my word for it. Set up your phone to use a stun server and get on with your life. It will all just go like a mad thing. And you will not have to forward. The only port you'll have to forward on your router is 5060 into one of your incoming SIP devices.
Oh, so if I use two SIP devices, then 5060 for one and 5061 for two, right, sir?
Well, yes, that would probably work, and you would have to forward a different port to each of the SIP devices, and you would actually have to configure the SIP device itself to use the alternate port. So I haven't looked at the Nokia's VoIP implementation, I have only looked at SJ phones, so I don't know whether you can configure the Nokia to use a stun surfer or anything like that. And obviously, as you can probably understand, this is not Let's Support Zoomin with VoIP. This is Discovery Module 6, so I can't spend too much time debugging your personal VoIP.
Yeah, thank you so much, sir. Thank you.
Otherwise, you can email me, and I can reply to you via email out of class time, and we might be able to sort a couple of your problems. Yes, Alex?
I'm just trying to test my mic works.
It's fine. Loud and clear.
And the other thing was, is there a lab on... a lecture on Module 4 from previous years?
No. There is no lecture on Lecture 4 for previous years, but I really want everybody to have a look through the notes and see if they think a Module 4 would be worthwhile. We can do one, but I basically it was all pretty straightforward, and it just basically talked about the different devices you'd find in an ISP, and it would also talk about... it didn't really tell you much about the devices at all. It was just sort of an overview thing. So if we do want a module 4 lecture, I can do one of those next week or later this week if I get through Module 6 stuff quickly. And you can hear all of my stories about there was this time that I worked for an ISP.
No, I was just curious.
Did that not have any content on cabling as well from memory? Hazy, man.
I don't think there was much on cabling, or at least if it was, I just sort of must have read it and... Yeah, most of the cabling stuff's gone. There's a little bit in there, but not a lot.
Maybe it was just only one bit of it, I don't know.
Basically, all they tell you about, generally speaking, is they tell you about twisted pair, and they tell you about straight-throughs and crossovers, and they don't actually say a lot about it. There used to be an incredible amount of stuff on cabling, including single-mode and multi-mode fibre, but all of that seems to have been ripped out.
Yes, so if anyone's interested in that stuff, I would refer people to the brilliant cabling lab that I think Kerry and Ian did a couple of years ago.
Yes. Did everybody see the links to those areas on the website where you can download the disassembly reassembly demo for ITE and the cabling demo for CCNA? Did everybody find those files? I went to special effort to jam some symlinks in.
Oh yeah, yep. I got it.
Okay. We may actually go through some of the cabling information from the older CCNA, although we need to figure out whether you guys are actually suffering from information overload. So we'll see how we go, because I can talk until the cows come home. Okay. Module 6. Module 6 is... has anybody got any other questions before I continue on to Module 6? Just so no pending questions? Alrighty, I'll assume there are no questions. Okay, and now, Perth is coming out of daylight savings this weekend. This weekend, on Sunday, we all wind our clocks back by an hour, so we get an extra hour's sleep. Lucky us. Or we get up really early and pretend we're going to be able to do this for the whole of winter and then sort of cop out about a week into it. So, this will mean that the time difference between India... and us, and the time difference between Grace and us, will become an hour less. So your lectures are going to start at 6:30 in the morning, if you're in India, rather than 5:30 in the morning, so you guys get an extra hour's sleep. Aren't we nice? I know this means that people aren't going to be able to stay as long, because you've got other commitments, and we do understand that. So if necessary, we will compress the lectures down, and get through as much as possible in the early part of the lecture. So everybody clear? The lecture is going to start an hour later for most people next week. It will start at 6:30 Indian time.
What time is that Perth time, Kerry? 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock?
It's still going to be from 9 to 11 Perth time, but you're going to be 2 hours ahead of us, so I don't...
No, we're actually 3 hours ahead of you because we don't drop back for our daylight saving until the first weekend in April. So there you go, we get it an hour later for a week. So there it is. So I just wanted to check. So 3 hours time difference, East Coast on Australian East Coast next week.
Okie dokie, so if you're on the Australian East Coast and you're not dropping back for daylight savings for another week, then you get to stick around and you'll be 3 hours different from us. Okay. Obviously, everybody here doesn't like daylight savings because, well, some of us do, but most people don't like daylight savings over here so because everybody finds the afternoons too hot. So, yeah? Because it's hot. Yeah, Geraldine likes daylight savings. Yeah, it's hot. It's hot. You can feel the heat. I'm not going to break into song, but yeah.
It's cool at the hottest part of the day, and all the Western Australians and Northern Territorians don't like it.
That's exactly right, and people want to sit on their balcony when it cools down and drink wine and sip wine and go, it's nice and cool now. Okay, back to Module 6. All right, 6:30, people, is when your lecture's going to be next week. Don't come on at 5:30 because we won't be here. It'll be very lonely, although you can talk amongst yourselves. Okay, Module 6 basically talks about the various protocols that make up the internet, and they talk about layered protocol thingos, which we will get to in a minute. Now, can anybody tell me the two primary protocols that are named when we talk about a certain protocol suite that makes the internet go round, or backwards and forwards, depending on how you look at it?
HTTP?
No, I want the two. I want the two mine major protocols.
TCP
and UDP.
I wanted TCP and IP. Everybody heard of TCP/IP?
That's why they put the slash between them.
Yes, TCP/IP. Okay, that is the name of the protocol suite. TCP/IP. In fact, there's dialogues in Windows that are called TCP/IP properties. And TCP/IP configuration, that is the name of the protocol suite. Suman is jumping ahead here. He's about 300 metres ahead of everybody else. And he's going on about the actual components of TCP. We'll get to that in a second. TCP/IP protocol suite was created in the late 60s by ARPANET, the Defence Academic Research and something network. And it was designed to create a network that would be fault-tolerant in the case of a nuclear war. Luckily, we didn't have one of those, but the internet had multiple backup links and multiple redundant connections, and it was supposed to be resistant to a nuclear attack if one was to happen. And they needed a whole lot of boffins and propeller heads to develop this technology, so they gave all the universities in the US access to the internet. I'm assuming, by the way, Grace, that you were going to say TCP and IP, just because I did actually see your request to... No, what were you going to say? You were going to say TCP and UDP, were you? Or did you want to say something else?
No, I was going to say TCP and UDP. Blah, sorry.
Okay, we'll get to TCP and UDP in a minute, but the protocol suite is actually called TCP/IP, and there are a whole lot of protocols in this suite. Hundreds. They do all different things. Yes? Somebody has a question about... Yes?
I do. Okay, so if TCP/IP is the protocol... aren't TCP and UDP protocols as well, or am I off somehow?
Yes, yeah. TCP is a protocol, IP is a protocol, and UDP is a protocol. And it's your lucky day because I'm going to talk about all of them today.
Okay.
Okay. Now, IP. Can anybody tell me what IP stands for?
Internet protocol? Yes.
Internet protocol.
Yeah, I'd go with that.
Yep, someone got it.
It is. Now, IP is the protocol that is it is concerned with the IP addresses, and the routing is done at the IP layer to get packets from one side of the network to the other. But IP is unreliable. It needs other protocols to prop it up. So IP is the internet protocol, and it works at layer 3 of the OSI reference model. We are going to talk about the OSI reference model, but who has not heard of the OSI reference model? I didn't ask you how you felt about the OSI reference model, or whether you needed therapy to do with the OSI reference model.
Believe you me, the person who hates it, they can actually learn to like it.
Yeah, that's what they told me about really Brussels sprouts. Fault. Oh, it is your book's fault. What can we say? I mean, you've got Geraldine and I, some of the best lecturers in the business, and modest too. And we'll be telling you all about the OSI reference model later. And you'll learn things like, please do not throw sausage pizza away. I don't want to talk about sausage pizza because it's making me hungry. People seem to need data processing. All people seem to need data processing is the one that goes the other way. Okay, please do not throw sausage pizza away. But we'll get to that later. Now, IP is the protocol that is responsible for dealing with the IP addresses and the routing. There are two other key protocols that are used in TCP/IP, which are the building blocks of the core protocol suite. One of them is TCP, Transmission Control Protocol. Okay, the other one is UDP, which is User Datagram Protocol. Now, I must stress, I stress a lot, that you need to be able to know more about these protocols than just being able to expand the acronyms. It might make you look clever to expand the TCP, Transmission Control Protocol, but we need you to understand basically what the protocols do. Now, TCP, Transmission Control Protocol, is a reliable end-to-end transport. Does anybody know what that means?
It means there's checks and balances.
There is communication between devices or computers.
We have one from Elise that says confirmation of data from end-to-end between two devices. I think that's what you essentially said, was it? Because I had Zoom and talking at the same time.
Yeah, that's okay.
So reliable end-to-end, and you open a connection, and you send data over it, and you close the connection down, and it doesn't send any data over it anymore. And when you open a TCP connection, you do what we call a three-way handshake. You send a SYN packet, which is a synchronization packet, which is used to synchronize the sequence numbers. You then get a receive an acknowledgement packet, and you send another synchronization packet after that. And the way I explain it to people is, say, for example, I wanted to talk to Grace, for example. I go, "Oi, Grace, I want to talk to you." And she go, "Who, me?" And I go, "Yeah, you." And we would be synchronized and ready to communicate. That's your three-way handshake. Okay, possibly a silly example, but it'll do. We actually do cover a lot more on sequence numbers and stuff in Discovery 2, and it doesn't actually talk about sequence numbers and SYN packets in Discovery 1, so I don't think I will go too heavily into it at the moment. But essentially, TCP has the ability to give you a reliable end-to-end connectivity, and it can have multiple conversation using what? Can anybody tell me the funny thing that starts with P that it uses to allow it to have multiple communications simultaneously? Interchat. Yes, we have a correct answer from Alex. Anybody else want to have a guess? Okay, it looks like everybody's going to have extra cups of coffee this morning.
Yes.
Yeah, ports. Ports is what we want. Ports is the correct answer. Okay. And remember, we talked all about ports last week, and we talked about how you have a source IP and a source port, and you open a connection to a target IP and a target port, and that is how you differentiate the connections. And then we wandered off down the garden path, around the shed, out the back gate, down to the shops, and back around the block, and we talked about network address translation and port tables and all that sort of stuff. Everybody remember all that from last week?
Sure did.
Okie dokie. Now, so you open your TCP connection and you send data and you receive data, and TCP has some algorithms that make it resilient to data corruption and wobble and stuff. Does anybody remember what happens when a network card on a local Ethernet segment is unable to send a packet for 16 consecutive retries?
Someone gives up.
Collision.
No. That's it drops it. Grace is correct. It drops it. And do we all remember what CSMA/CD stands for? because that'll probably be in your test.
Carrie says access with collision detection, I think.
You are correct. I know. I'm not fair, am I? I'm asking questions from Module 3. That was weeks ago.
I just didn't want to type it in the chat.
Okay, so it drops it. Now, if you have a web page and your computer decides it's going to drop 6 out of the 12 packets on the page, the JPEGs are going to look pretty cruddy. So we can't have that. So HTTP, which is Hypertext Transfer Protocol, usually listens on port 80 for a server that's listening for HTTP, and we'll talk about clients and servers in a minute. It will tend to use TCP, which is a reliable transmission of packets. Now, what TCP does is it sends out a packet, and it waits for an acknowledgement. And if it doesn't get the packet, it sends it out again. But it has what we call an exponential backoff algorithm, which means that, say, for example, it doesn't get a packet, it will send out a packet, say, I don't know, a quarter of a second after it didn't get an acknowledgement. And then if it doesn't get an acknowledgement again, it'll wait half a second, and then it'll wait 1 second, and then it'll wait 2 seconds, and then it'll wait 4 seconds, and then it'll wait 8 seconds. And the times that it retransmits get longer and longer and longer as it tries to retransmit the packet. Can anybody have a guess at why TCP does have an exponential backoff algorithm?
To avoid collisions? Or help avoid collisions?
Yes, partially. What do you think the other thing the exponential backoff algorithm could possibly avoid? I'll give you a clue. Traffic jam.
I was going to speculate. Would flow control or something, or traffic jamming be it?
Network congestion. If you've got these hosts that are retransmitting hundreds and hundreds of packets again over and over because they didn't get an acknowledgement, you are going to saturate the network big time. And that is going to make the problem worse. Okay. Now, the other thing TCP has is it has sequence numbers, which obviously start at different points, and they keep the packets in sequence. Because one of the things you've got to realise about IP, which was the one of the underlying protocols we were talking about earlier, is that it is possible for IP to actually deliver packets out of order. So you can get packet 1, packet 4, packet 3, and packet 2. So what TCP has is it has sequence numbers so that it can reassemble the packets into the correct order. Well, they're actually called segments at this level. Reassemble the segments into the correct order. Allow you to resequence those packets so that you actually get a valid stream. Okay. Now, the other thing TCP has is it has what we call a sliding window. Can anybody tell me what a sliding window is? Can anybody tell me generally what a sliding window is? Like in real, like life terms, as far as apart from computers.
Which opens to side?
Yeah, they do. They can open. Yeah, the windows can slide open and shut, or they can slide up and down and obviously open and shut. Okay, so what happens with a sliding window? Okay. It doesn't jam at all. This is a good window. It's not Windows sliding windows. It's regular implementation.
Well, you did ask.
No, if it's American time, it's only the 20th. There we go, just stopping Geraldine from having heart failure over there. Okay, sliding window. So what happens with a sliding window is you send out a packet and you actually say to the receiver, I am happy to receive 10 packets worth of data without getting an acknowledgement. And so what you do is you go packet 1, packet 2, packet 3, packet 4, packet 5, packet 6, packet 7, packet 8, packet 9, packet 10. And the other end goes, yeah, I got packet 1, I got packet 2, I got packet 3. And you then go, okay, I've seen those three packets, so I'm going to send packet 11, packet 12, packet 13. And then you don't get packet 4. So you have to retransmit packet 4 because you didn't get an acknowledgement for that. And then the other end says, I've got packet 4, 5, and 6. And it goes, yeah, all right, so I'll send some more packets. So in other words, you're keeping the window full of packets, up to 10. Although there is what we call window scaling that I don't want to talk about. And basically what you do is you keep sliding the window forward into the future, so you increase the packet numbers as the packets get acknowledged. Does anybody understand that, or have I just managed to confuse the trop out of you? Can anybody tell me why such a system would be useful?
So that your connection doesn't just completely terminate and you've got to reconnect because there are no packets in there?
Partially, not quite. Good guess, but not quite along the lines I'm after. Anybody else want to have an idea why a sliding window would be useful? There are two reasons.
To organize packets properly?
No, not really. We'll take one more guess, and then I'll put you all out of your misery. Okay, we don't win the car this week, so let's explain it. If you have a sliding window, you end up with... say, for example, you've got a link that has a very high turnaround, for example, a satellite link. Sometimes the turnaround time on a satellite can be 1.5 to 3 seconds. So if I am having a conversation with Elise and I ask her to acknowledge every single thing I say... I'd be going, hi, Elise. You'd be going, good. Hi. How you doing? I'm good. Oh, by the way, did you hear about such and such? Yes, I did. And did you also hear? Yeah. And did you also hear? Yeah. And it would be very slow because I'm waiting for the acknowledgements to come back. So, in other words, I'm waiting on the acknowledgements to come back before I'm sending another packet. So if we're looking at a link with a round-trip time of, say, 1.5 seconds, like a satellite, you send out a packet, you then wait 1.5 seconds for your latency to your packet to come back, and your acknowledgement, and then you send out another packet, you're going to get a packet every 1.5 seconds, and throughput is going to be crummy. Yeah. So, what you do in this particular situation is you send out packets, and then as the acknowledgement comes back from the other end, you keep sending out more packets and more packets as more acknowledgements come back, so that the data flow is smooth and uninterrupted.
So you might say to me, okay, Kerry, did you hear about X? Did you hear about Y? Did you hear about Z, let's say, and one acknowledgement from me would do?
Well, what you would actually say to me is, yeah, I heard about X, Y, and Z. But if you'd said to me, I heard about X and Y, I'd go, oh, so did you hear about Z? So I'd actually have to check with you on Z if you only... Yeah.
So would that mean that you'd be sending that Z packet again for wanting to express it?
Yes, I would. Yes. Yes, I would send the Z packet again.
And then I acknowledge it on the second time because I failed to, for whatever reason, because I wasn't concentrating, I missed what you said. So I have to. So you have to resend the Z packet again for me to respond.
Yeah, don't you love these lectures? I say I'm talking about chapter 6 and then...
I like analogies.
And I go into all sorts of things that actually aren't in your module notes. How confusing. Okay, so that's how your sliding window works, and we have what we call window scaling. And you can actually change the size of the window as the link conditions get better or worse, depending on the propagation delay and the packet drop rate. And the other thing to note about TCP is it has what we call a slow start. In other words, it starts off slowly, and it then continues to increase its speed until it's reached the maximum speed that you're likely to achieve over the link. Now, here's an interesting question. Has anybody ever wondered why the Microsoft Internet Explorer or Firefox download speed meter is so unreliable? And you go, well, gee, Microsoft can't even do anything right. Has anybody ever wondered about that? Or, in fact, Mozilla can't do anything right.
Well, I have, actually.
Has anybody else wondered why the download speed meter is so inaccurate?
Well, yeah.
No. Okay, think about the problem that we're trying to deal with. How are you going to measure the speed of data coming down. Are you measuring the speed of data coming down as in how fast it's coming down right now? And if so, what is your sample time going to be? Or are you measuring the speed of how fast data has come down since the beginning of the transfer? So what happens, and I don't know whether anybody has seen this phenomenon, you start a download off, and it's quite a high-speed download, which is a bit unusual, but there it is, and you spend a good 20, 30, 40 seconds figuring out where you're going to save the file and clicking through 10 levels of folder and then bouncing around and then finally hitting the save button. And for the first 15, 20 seconds of your download, it claims that it's going at like 200k a second and you go, ha, 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 my internet is so fast. How cool is that? Anybody done that?
Yep, I've seen it start off quick and then drop back.
Okay, and then it falls, it plummets, and you see the numbers go down, and you don't know how low it's going to go, but you're just hoping that it's not going to go too low. What the download meter actually does is it counts up the time of the download in seconds, and it divides those number of seconds by the number of kilobytes you have retrieved so far. So when you hit the save button, because it's already received, say, 300k, it's received 300k in 1 second, because as far as it hasn't actually started counting until you've hit the save button, and then as the time increases, it then divides the number of seconds by the number of k you've received, and because the number of k you've received has fallen compared to the number of seconds, that is why the number actually falls. So it's actually an average over the entire time the download is run, as in how much data you received and how many k a second that actually is. That wasn't in our course at all, but there you go.
So would that then mean, Kerry, the longer you leave it and muck around with, you know, clicking through your myriad of folders and wherever you want to save this file you're downloading to on your hard drive or your network, the more profound this seemingly higher speed will be at the beginning of the, when you do actually press your save button and start it off?
Yes. Yes, it is. The way you can sort of, I mean, and we get into some quite advanced topics, which we're not going to get into, like traffic shaping and how you control this traffic and how you stop your BitTorrent from wiping out your voice over IP or whatever you're doing. And these actual packet flow speeds are what's important and different algorithms for queuing them. But essentially, yeah, you can probably get it to say that it's going to come down at 600k a second and then it'll come down as time advances. So the actual speed of the download meter is actually working by showing you the number of K downloaded versus the time that the download has been running, which is why the actual performance figures look sticky and take a while to respond to changes in network conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody got any questions?
While I'm pinging any particular IP addresses there, I noticed milliseconds. Is that the same latency you're talking about, sir? I mean, sending packets and waiting for the acknowledgement, all those things?
It depends on what sort of link you have. If you have a dial-up connection to the internet, you're looking at latency times of, say, 150 to 300 milliseconds. Whereas if you are looking at, say, an ADSL connection or whatever, you're looking at latencies of 10 to 30 milliseconds. And if you're looking at Ethernet, if you're looking at 10 megabit Ethernet, you might be looking at latencies of, say, 1 to 3 milliseconds. Or you might be looking at 0. milliseconds. I'm just seeing if this person who's just got to move a user.
So that milliseconds gap is the time taken for sending and receiving packets?
Just give me a second. I've just moved you into the lecture theatre, Venkatesh. You hadn't moved yourself into the lecture theatre. Here's where we all are. Okay, now the latency time for a ping is the round trip time. How long did it take your packet to reach the destination, and how long did it take the destination packet to come back?
Oh, okay.
But there are times when you can get too obsessed with latency, and in fact gamers get obsessed with latency. They want latency that's, you know, under 10 milliseconds and stuff, and they don't realise that it's not only their packets that are travelling on the internet, there's everybody else. That's, you know, there's Elise watching YouTube videos, there's, I don't know what else there is, but there's all sorts of things.
Especially in probably your household and mine, where there's multiple computers sharing the one connection.
Sorry, can I just have that again? Elise, in my house, what, sorry?
Especially in both our households, where there's multiple computers sharing the one connection. You know, you might have Gemma doing something, and you're in another room doing something else, as is I've got many computers here all sharing the same internet connection, so if I do something too intensive on one, it could have a profound effect on one of the others.
Okay, once the download speed has been determined, can the upload speed be determined on the same computer? Absolutely not. What if you've got an ADSL connection that is 1.5 megabits down and 256 kilobits up? You must measure the download speed and upload speed independently. Okay, now we talked about TCP and we talked about IP. Now UDP is User Data Program Protocol. And it also has connectionless operation. In other words, it's a fire and forget. It's a bit like a cannonball. You send out the packet, you don't look for any acknowledgement, and if the packet either gets there or it doesn't, it can be eaten in cyberspace or, as we say, dropped into the big bit bucket in the sky. Can anybody tell me one of the applications that reuses UDP? You can either type it into chat or you can tell me one of the applications that might make use of User Datagram Protocol.
Internet radio?
Yeah, that's what the notes say.
All major applications like HTTP and the one we are using, Ventrilo.
No, you're wrong. HTTP is runs over TCP. It does not use UDP. Not all P2P uses UDP. When he says P2P, he's referring to peer-to-peer, things such as BitTorrent, Emule, LimeWire, Kazaa, Ares Galaxy, need I go on. They actually use a combination of TCP and UDP. They use UDP packets for their DHT, which is a distributed hash table, which is how you find other nodes in the peer-to-peer network, so you can share your wares and you can be elite hacker type. And it uses TCP for the actual data transfer, because you don't require the DHT to be reliable, but you do require the data transmission to be reliable. Now, some internet radio does use UDP, although a lot of it I've seen uses TCP. And they use TCP rather than UDP. The notes say that internet radio does use UDP, but I'm not sure which style of internet radio does use UDP, because I've always seen shoutcast streams and stuff using using HTTP or TCP. Okay, Skype uses TCP and UDP. It uses TCP for sending the actual voice packets and stuff, and it uses UDP for the presence detection, in other words, to tell the Skype servers or the network of Skype servers whether you are online or not. Can anybody think of another internet protocol that predominantly uses UDP? Your dog's dreaming. SIP actually uses TCP and UDP, just to make your life difficult, but primarily it does use TCP. UDP, I should say. UDP. No, Skype... MSN uses TCP. RTP does, in fact, use UDP. Yes, you've got a one. I'm looking for a really simple protocol that you use every day when you go to www.imbored.com. What protocol starts the first start of the www.imbored?
No, I don't know.
Would you believe DNS?
Okay, yeah, sure. So DNS uses UDP.
Well, if a DNS query fails, it's not critical. It's annoying, but it's not critical. The retries and stuff aren't, you know, critical. So if the DNS sort of fails or times out or doesn't work, I mean, obviously things stop working. And everybody knows that DNS is the domain name system, and it is responsible for mapping names such as www.qcat.org to 203.101.99.234. And DNS uses has different sorts of records. It's got A records, which map names to IP addresses. It has CNAME records, which map names to other names. So www.myfunkycompany.com is a CNAME for bigwhoppingserver.mycompany.com, so that you can move the web server just by changing the canonical name record. You should not point a www at an A record. Smack. No, it's a canonical name.
No, I'm saying that child name is also a part of DNS.
Names are part of DNS, and I'm just going to very briefly talk about how DNS works. It's not really in the notes, but there is sort of a lab that I could make you all do on it, so we'll talk about it. Okay, so say, for example, we are looking up... we are looking up lonsdalemedia.com.au because we'd like to see what Melbourne looks like in the daytime. The first thing, our name server... It knows about the root name servers. Now, the root name servers are the ones that can tell you about any other domains on the internet. So they are actually what we call DOT. In other words, a fully qualified domain name in DNS actually ends in a DOT because that's the name of the root name server. So we look up www.lonsdalemedia.com.au. Our bind, or whichever resolver we're using, looks up and says, give me the names of the name servers for .au. And the root name servers say, oh, well, there's one at Monari, and there's one at Monash, and there's this other one, and there's this other one, and this other one. And the name server goes, okay. It then hands its query to one of those name servers that it's been handed back from the root name servers and says, what is... can you tell me that some name servers.com.au? Can you tell me any name servers.com.au? And that says, oh yeah, there's this one here at dnsrocks.com.au, and there's another one here at this one, another one here at this one. It goes, all right. The resolver then goes and asks, who is lonsdalemedia.com.au? And it asks the .com.au name servers. And they go, oh, lonsdalemedia.com.au is a canonical name for, I don't know, and it hands back the address information. Now, the DNS information, the DNS server, or the resolver, actually caters this information, because if you had to ask your way all the way down from the root name servers every time, not only would you put incredible load on the root name servers, but you would also overload the internet with DNS queries. And basically what comes back with each DNS record is what we call a time to live, which is how long the record is going to be cached by the name servers. And a lot of people set their TTL values, their default TTL values for their zone, which are in the start of authority record, which I'm not going into, to 86,400, which is one day, which means it will take a day for any caches to potentially forget about your DNS information if they've already asked a question beforehand. Any questions on that? Yes, Elise?
Getting used to a new keyboard here. So does that have to do with propagation when we move a domain and change its name server records, and we go, right, this domain is now no longer with Zone Edit, it's with, you know, some other authority system? And or are we talking about something different here?
Well, the TTL records are on all records in the DNS. They're either defaults in the start of authority, or there are actually TTL values on each of the records that goes into the DNS. And when you actually register a domain, all you do is point name server records at a name server records at a particular set of domain name servers, and then they are considered authoritative for that domain. And yes, there are TTL records on those name server records, and that will reflect how long it's going to take for changes to the DNS to occur. Yeah. Can anybody tell me what would happen if you set your TTL too low? This record is only valid for 60 seconds, so no. What would happen if you set all the...
The domain would either drop off the internet or not be visible to the internet, or it would have to keep asking and then chew up a heap of resources as every time it's been looked up. Would that be right?
Well, yes, the domain wouldn't necessarily drop off the internet, but you would actually increase the traffic to and from your name servers quite significantly, because every time you, say for example, the TTL on lonsdalemedia.com.au was 60 seconds, which it isn't, you would ask the .com.au name servers who is lonsdalemedia.com.au, and you would only be allowed to hang on to that answer for 60 seconds before you ditch it from the cache. And that would put a lot of load on the .com.au name servers, and you might get into a bit of trouble.
Especially when, if you hopefully got a good website and people visit longer than 60 seconds and take longer than 60 seconds to actually read the text on a page, and when they call up another page due to one of your hyperlinks in your website, you'd have to re-request all that name server information.
Well, you would at least have to re-request the lonsdalemedia.com.au query. You probably wouldn't have to request the other ones because they've got sensible TTLs on them.
Yeah, no, but what I'm saying is if the TTL is too short, you would have to re-request all that information. So it's, as you say, rather cool to have it a long time.
Exactly, and generally people recommend that your TTL on most records should be at least an hour or two at a bare minimum. That would be, unless you are using dynamic DNS, and there are actually reasons for you to have low TTLs on a dynamic DNS, and they recommend you have a TTL of, say, 5 or 10 minutes on a dynamic DNS record, because obviously you want those to change very easily.
Yep, no, that makes sense. Thanks.
Okie dokie. So we've talked about TCP, we've talked about IP, we've talked about UDP, and we have talked about HTTP. Now, HTTP uses TCP. FTP uses TCP. POP and IMAP use TCP. And a lot of these programs that require reliable end-to-end delivery of data use TCP. Okay. The other thing that is worth mentioning is... Now, this is Grace's favourite part of the lesson. Guess what we're just about to talk about? Nobody's guessing what we're just about to talk about? Okay. We are about to talk about layered network models. Yeah, we are going to talk about the OSI reference model. There are two networking models in existence. There are lots of networking models in existence. There are two networking models in existence that we concern ourselves with. The first one is the internet model. It has four layers. The lowest layer is the network access layer. The next layer is the networking layer. The next layer is the transport layer, I think, and then the top one is the application layer. I think I've got that right.
Have to go and look up. There's an internet layer in there somewhere too. I can look at my notes.
Ah, yes, there's a network access layer, an internet layer, a transport layer, and an application layer.
It's funny, I remember the OSI reference model easier than the TCP one.
Okay, now the thing with a layered model of networking, the reason we break things into layers is because it does make it easier to understand. Picture yourself a big jam and cream sponge cake. And at the bottom you've got sponge, and then you've got jam, and then you've got more sponge, and then you've got cream, and then you've got more sponge, and then you've got icing sugar. Okay. Yeah, okay. Now, these are the different layers of the sponge cake. We've got a sponge layer at the base, we've got a jam layer, we've got a cream layer, and we've got a sponge layer. Okay, so we've got multiple sponge layers.
I'm hungry.
Yeah, sponge cake. Okay. Okay, we're all hungry. I've succeeded in getting you all hungry. I mean, we could talk about apple pie layers. No, okay. Let's get back to network layers. So, at the bottom of the TCP IP model, we have the network access layer. It is the network layer that is responsible for giving you access to the network. So we're talking about network cards, ADSL modems, Ethernet, all of that sort of stuff falls into the network access layer. We then have, on top of that, we have an internet layer, which is responsible for your IP addresses and your routing and stuff. And then above that, we have the, I'm pretty sure it's the transport layer, I'd have to check that.
Transport layer, which is mapping something or other I've got written here.
Yeah, TCP and stuff, you were dealing with your TCP and your UDP and those sorts of things. And then the top layer is the application layer. So when an application wants to talk to stuff on a TCP IP network, it has to start at the application layer. It has to send packets down through the transport layer, they then go through the internet layer, they then go through the network access layer, they travel along the network, zap, 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 they come back up through the network access layer, back up through the internet layer, back up through the transport layer, and back up to the application layer. Okay, can anybody tell me how many layers are in the OSI reference model? Seven. There are seven. Okay. Now, I could be really tedious and start off and go, and the packet starts off at the top of the application layer. It starts at the application layer and goes down to the presentation layer. The packet has now traveled down through the presentation layer and down to the session layer. The packet is going well down to the session layer and down to the transport layer. Okay, but that's enough of that.
All right.
We are indeed. Now, the packet... there are seven layers in the OSI reference model, and by the end of this course, you will know what all seven are. Anybody tell me what the first layer is?
Layer one or layer seven?
Network access.
Physical layer. We're talking about. We're talking about. Yeah, and we're not having the song, okay?
Physical.
We went through all the
Okay. Layers. Physical layer is the one that has all of the stuff like cables and connectors and all that stuff, and voltages and signaling methods. Okay, the next layer up from that's P for please. The next layer is D for do. And anybody tell me what the next layer up from the physical link layer is? Yes, data link. Okay, and that is where we do our framing and our layer 2 stuff, like our Ethernet and stuff, except Ethernet breaks the data link layer into two, which we will talk about at some point, but not right now. It breaks it into the media access control layer, and it breaks it into the logical link control layer. Okay, the third layer, which is not, please do not, what is not? Networking. It's the networking layer. And it is responsible for getting your packets and your IP addresses and stuff, so it's responsible for your addressing information and that sort of stuff. The next layer from that is T for throw. Can anybody tell me what the next layer is for? Yes, transport. Okay, the transport layer is responsible for end-to-end reliability, packet retransmission, and error detection and correction. The next layer above the transport layer is the sausage layer. Can anybody tell me what the...
Session!
The sausage session layer. Sausages. We could have some sausages and then we could have some sponge cake. Now that sounds like a really good idea. Session is where you open up a session and you talk to people and then you close the session down, such as your TCP sessions and things. Next layer above session is P for pizza. Can anybody tell me what the pizza layer is? Yes, presentation layer. And the presentation layer is responsible for character set conversion and making sure the data is understandable by the application. And then there's one layer above that, which is A for away. Anybody tell me what the application layer? Somebody studied this before. Okay, so we have physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application. Did I miss one? Physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application. There we go. Now, it's very important that you know what all of those layers do and eventually what they are and what they all do. And you will know it by the end of the course. and you look at it and go, oh, it's all so complicated, why do they have to be 7 layers? Well, that's because a whole committee designed this, and it has 7 layers, and it's horrific, and it's a good model for comparing protocols, and it breaks the functions of the protocols down into easily digestible bits. So that is what these 7 layers are for. Okay, so a packet starts at the application layer. Let's say we are looking at the OSI reference model, and we are looking at it in relation to, say, browsing a web page. Our web browser communicates with the application layer. It sends out a request to get a page. The request goes down through the presentation layer where character set stuff is concerned. It goes down through the session layer, which is where we open up the TCP session and make sure we can communicate. It goes down through the transport layer, which then makes sure that the packets and stuff are in the right order and get retransmitted. It goes down through the networking layer, which is responsible for getting the packets from A to B and making sure the routing occurs properly. It then goes down through the data link layer, which makes sure that the framing and stuff on the Ethernet and the modem lines are correct. It then goes down through the physical layer, and it goes all the way down to the bottom of the physical layer. Guess what? At the other end, it goes back up through the physical layer, and it goes to the data link layer, and the knee bone's connected to the elbow bone. Okay. No, it's not. You'd have a problem if your knee was connected to your elbow. So, you go from the physical layer to the data link layer, and you go from the data link layer to the network layer, and we're just seeing where the trail ends work. We go from the network layer to the transport layer. We go from the transport layer to the session layer, from the session layer to the presentation layer, and the presentation layer to the application layer. Okay. Anybody follow that, or do we want a real-world example? Any questions?
I saw a really good real-world example last year somewhere where somebody was sending an email to, like, off one computer down from the application layer, down into the presentation layer, down into the session layer, the transport layer, the network layer, the data link layer, gets to the physical wire on the...
Identified an example when turned.
And then it comes back up again when it's received. It comes back up across the wire, up through the data link layer, up through the network layer, up through the transport layer, up through the session layer, up through the presentation layer where the character set's done, and it's presented to, last of all, the application layer, which then, of course, presents it to the user.
That is correct. And that is the 8th layer of the OSI reference model that we call the bogon layer, which breaks all the other ones, which is the user, or the loose nut sitting in front of the computer. Okay, good morning, Gemma. I didn't get to ring you because lecture started, but that's all good. Now, we're going up and down the OSI reference model, and we're not connecting our knees to our elbows. That is exactly right, Elise. You send an email from your email program, and it talks to the application. I don't have to go through that again, okay? I think Elise did, but you get the idea. It goes all the way down and all the way back up the other side. We had this example that we used to use, which was where... Gemma was trapped in her bedroom, and I was trapped in the lounge room, and we had to get a message from her to me, but her mother was on the phone in the middle, which means you can't get any messages through. So what we would do is we would take the message, and we would write it on a piece of paper. We would then stick it to the collar of the dog. We would then send the dog through to the other room, and then the other person would remove the message from the collar of the dog and read the message, and then write another message and stick it to the collar of the dog and send the dog back through. That's just an example of the layered model of networking. Obviously, you would have to have biscuits at either end to tempt the dog to go backwards and forwards, and it would only work for a certain amount of time before the dog wouldn't be interested in the biscuits anymore, but you get the idea. The other example we usually have is sending a letter, and I think last year I was singing Take a Letter, Maria, and Send It to My Wife or something, which I won't redo this year. Because I value my students. So what you do is you write a letter and you encapsulate or stick it in an envelope. And the envelope is sort of like the physical layery sort of thing. And then, well, actually, it's sort of like the data link layer, actually. And you write an address on the envelope, which is the address that you want it to go to and the address it came from, which is a bit like your destination and source IP address. And then you give it to the postie, and he takes it on one of those horrible little motorbikes that makes a racket and screeches past your house every day. And that's the transport layer. And then we don't really have an acronym for the session layer, but you also have the transport layer, which then is responsible for getting it through the different mail exchanges in combination with the network layer, so to speak. And then it goes all the way down, and it gets to the other end, and it comes back from... You get your envelope, and you take the letter out of the envelope, so you're decapsulating it, and obviously the postie delivered it to you, and it came from the mail exchanges, so that's how this symmetrical method of network transport sort of works. Now, was that any clearer than the book, or should I go take up singing? And if you said something... Ah, good. Okay. So that's how this layered method works. Now, the reason we use layering is because what you can actually do with these layers is you can change one particular layer. So, for example, you can change the network layer without changing any of the other layers. So the network layer is talked to by the transport layer, and the network layer talks to the data link layer, but if you actually change the networking layer in the middle, you can leave the data link and the transport layers alone, and you can actually change aspects of the network without actually changing all of the protocols. So for an example of this is you can send Ethernet over Ethernet frames over copper, fiber, or wireless. And we just change the data link layers and stuff to make those changes take effect, but we leave all the packet formats and stuff the same. Has anybody got any questions? And can I have sponge cake is not a valid question.
Oh, come on, send it over. It won't be so bad, you know, with the 2 weeks in the mail.
Oh, it takes about 2 months for stuff to get to India. They wouldn't want their cake by the time it got to them. Okie dokie. Has anybody got any questions on any of that? All that sort of kind of stuff as clear as mud? That's what we like to hear. Alrighty. We have... the other thing I found out the other day. A couple of things. Which are not exactly relevant to the lecture, but somebody will be interested. There is an accessible way of cloning up your machine, which is faster than using DD. There is a DD devotee on this list that DDs up their hard drive and jams them in and out of removable caddies. Faster than you can say, oh, I just trashed insert system name, I'll just DD another copy across. I would point this user at NTFS clone, which will actually only back up the used data blocks on an NTFS volume and would be much faster cloning than what it would be...
It's interesting because I was thinking about it this morning because on the newer computer I've got bigger partitions and that might be interesting information to have. Thank you, Terry.
The other thing that is worth mentioning is that there is a talking, yes, you heard me, talking, accessible, talking distribution of Linux called GRML, www.grml.org. It talks, it's accessible, it talks, and it's accessible, and... it uses your sound card. That's right, no longer do you have to be impoverished without hardware speech. You can use... Yes, it does, it talks.
Are we talking the command line talk? As in like...
Yes, the command line talk.
Cool stuff, so we don't have to run Orca in a terminal window or something crazy.
No. You put this thing in, you get the latest version of GRML, which is GRML 2008.11. You boot from the CD. If you can't boot from the CD, I can't help you with that. You'll have to work that out yourself. And you type in Linux space SWSpeak equals eSpeak. And it says, please type SWSpeak once booting is complete. And the CD sort of whirs and clicks a bit more, and then it goes, and you go, well, how am I going to know when booting is complete? But before you've even had time to finish wondering, it goes, booting is now complete. Now type SWSpeak. And you go, booting must be complete. I'll type SWSpeak. Hang on.
Is this a Debian derivative or a Red Hat derivative?
I know why you want me to cut and paste. You type the URL. You guys are all cut and paste people. Yes, it's a Debian. It is a Debian derivative. It used to be based on GNOPix, but it is now based on Debian. And using amazing things such as Union Mounts and SquashFS, you actually get 2.2 gig of software on the CD. And I must stress that you need the full-sized CD. The medium and the small ones do not have SpeakUp or the software speech on them. You have been warned.
Right. So can we just burn this out to a normal CD and it does something crazy?
Would I dare suggest anything to these students that cost money? Exactly. Because I don't want to hear the violins that will result from how much money everybody doesn't have because of the global credit crunch crisis. Okay. It's free. As in beer. So you just download a copy and you can use it and boot it up and stuff. And it's got whole lots of utilities for mounting NTFS file systems read-write. That's right, NTFS file systems read-write. Unlike Fedora, who refuses to bundle any NTFS read-write support in, so you've got to go and snarf the RPMs.
No, you don't have to. It does in version 10 and I think also 9, actually.
Do you know which NTFS driver they bundle in, whether it's the kernel one or the fuse one, or no idea? NTFS 3G or the other one?
I couldn't tell you offhand, I'd have to go and check, but I remember that I didn't have to install it the last time I did one at Christmas time, which was Fedora 10.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't come with their server operating systems. You don't get it with CentOS, for example.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
Well, there were some licensing concerns and stuff because there was a whole lot of reverse engineering work that went into getting the NTFS stuff working. And in fact, NTFS was very difficult to get working because Microsoft wasn't interested in telling them how NTFS worked.
Not the point, they probably didn't know.
Well, it was probably hidden in some internal document somewhere that nobody could find. But yes, GRML.
I have a feeling yes, Ubuntu picked it up. I could be wrong. I have a suspicion I might be wrong. No, I think Ubuntu, the 8.10, I think, picked it up too.
It was in 8.04.
Yeah, it was in 8.04, then 8.10 would definitely do it. Because I seem to remember plugging an NTFS drive in there and it worked.
Ubuntu uses NTFS 3G by default rather than the kernel driver. There are actually a couple of different NTFS projects.
I used to put the NTFS 3G on my 8s and 9s, and as I said, I just don't know how 10 did it. I didn't look, it just went.
And very difficult file system to debug, and a lot of people complained that they didn't have write support and they wanted access to all these Windows drives, but what a lot of people didn't realise was that write support on your valuable data, especially if you've got it wrong, is very dangerous. Just scribble over a couple of indexes and who knows how much of your MP3 collection just went west. No, the restore software was called NTFS Clone, and it is part of the GRML distribution.
Can it do a running system, though? Probably not.
No, you boot off the CD.
Oh, I see. I gotcha.
I'm talking about solutions for impoverished people.
What is it?
Yes, Suman.
What is the system requirements, sir? System requirements?
Go look up the GRML website. I believe it's 256 meg of RAM, a CD-ROM drive, the ability to boot from a CD, and obviously a burnt copy of the CD. Most sound cards are supported, and it... I said most. Knowing your luck, yours won't be. What a lot of people don't realise is that getting a lot of sound cards to work under any operating system is almost impossible. How many times do you install Windows and then load on your sound card drivers? Linux is no different, OS X is no different. You need drivers for the sound card or whatever to make it work, and if you don't know about drivers, refer to Geraldine's IT lectures. But it's very difficult to get every quirky sound card in the world working off a live CD, although Linux does do most of them. If you do Linux space SWSpeak equals eSpeak at the command prompt and hit enter, and your CD goes whir and doesn't talk, then you can pretty much assume that your sound card is not supported. That's the whole point.
And that's why I was saying, can it do a running system? And probably not, so you would put it on a bootable entity and get your petition, I guess, similar to what I do with the cat, and plonk it somewhere safe.
One of the problems with doing running systems is when the operating systems have files open and locked, how do you decide when it is a consistent time to back them up?
No, I think it's safer to do always a non-running system than any system. So find a way of booting your computer up other than the main system, and then I assume this thing runs very much like DD. You just do it from a partition level, I guess, and just take an image of that partition, or how's it work?
That is essentially how it works, and for partitions that you don't want to DD, you can then use you can use DD. It has DD on it, of course, if you want to use DD off it. And I believe that GRML can be installed onto thumb drives and flash drives, and it can also be run off removable hard drives, or it can actually be installed on actual hard drives. It does not, to my knowledge, have Orca, it does not have a GUI, and it does not have Firefox. You have been warned. If you want all of those things, you want VI Ubuntu. VI Ubuntu is a distribution on viubuntu.co.uk or .org.uk, I think it is, I have to check. Google up VI Ubuntu, you'll find it easily enough. And it will actually come up talking, and if you have a Braille display connected, it will come up with Braille as well. If, however, you do want to back up a running system, there are certain utilities that will do it for you. I have used Ghost, both the old version of the Ghost that does shut your system down and the one that does take live images of your machine. It uses the volume shadow copy service to take up as live a copy of your system as it can. It's not always 100% safe, and the less things you have open, the better. The other thing I have actually purchased, and yes, it did cost money, was Drive Image, and I bought it from terabyteunlimited.com. It is excellent and fairly accessible, and if you actually boot the Drive Image for Linux CD, it will actually grab itself an IP address from the DHCP server, fire up an SSH server, and you can SSH into it and restore the images from the Linux bootable CD, which I've yet to try.
What is the best antivirus software you suggest as which is best accessible with JAWS?
I'm sorry, I don't have enough money to pay a lawyer, therefore I will not be answering that question. No, I'm perfectly serious. I cannot tell you what the best one is, and the best one for me isn't the best one for you. I personally run AVG, actually bought AVG antivirus only, version 8.5. The anti-spyware and firewall is inaccessible. Other people run Nod32, other people run Avast, other people run Antivir. It all depends on what's good for you. You really do have to go through and try them all and have a few of them hose your system, and then figure out which one is best for you.
I'm messing around the Kaspersky, which is not at all accessible.
Yes, Kaspersky is a bit of a problem, and there are a couple of them that are difficult to use. Look, it's a difficult thing because I don't like to tell people which antivirus or anti-spyware they should be using, because I don't want to be responsible for their data, and when their antivirus or anti-spyware happens to miss one virus and trashes their system, I don't want them coming back to me and having a big complaint. Personally,
also, I was just going to say there's a number, you know, you can download trial copies and try them out.
Absolutely, and that's the best thing to do, to try out the different ones. I personally run AVG antivirus only for my antivirus, and I actually paid for it. I'm not just running the free one, because you actually get faster updates if you pay for it. And I'm running Spybot Search and Destroy. Spybot Search and Destroy.
Yeah, I got the full suite given to me when my license for spyware died because they changed the engine. They gave me a license that would do the lot, so I put that on here and it's been all right.
And good morning to Pratig, who had a bit of a sleep in this morning. Yes, but one of the things you've got to keep in mind, and there is actually a mode that you have to toggle NOD32 back into classic mode, if you have no vision at all, a lot of these antivirus and anti-spyware things pop up dialogues that... you can't read with JAWS or Window Eyes or any of your assistive technology. And what's the point of having spyware when every time you get a piece of spyware, your anti-spyware thing locks your machine so hard you can't access it?
I just got one now. I just saw it visually. I got no idea what it said because I didn't get there fast enough to read it. And it came, and this is ABG, by the way. Vets are notorious at it, popping stuff out by the system tray, which I've got a license for as well on another computer. And I got no idea what it's up to half the time.
I hear good responses about NOD32, although I personally haven't tried it, and there is a classic mode you have to toggle it into. Aaron finds one of the internet security products, I've got to remember which one it is, not too bad. Apparently people said good things about Microsoft Defender for a while, and then they stopped saying good things about it. Apparently the Microsoft OneCare stuff isn't too bad either. It costs money though.
Yeah, but what's your security worth, eh?
Well, this is right. How much is your data worth and how much is your security worth? So it really depends on how much you want to spend on your antivirus and how important your data is. There is also ClamAV. There is I think there's a WinAV version of that. I have no idea whether it's accessible or not, but it's a free virus scanner that works with... ClamAV usually works with... that's email scanning and various Unixes and OS X and stuff. You get ClamAV and Spam Assassin.
And yeah, there is an antivirus called Avira. Perhaps you might knowing about that. That's also a very good one. Plus, there is...
One point. What? Stop there. Stop there for a second. Antivir is incompatible with VMware. You are going to run into all sorts of problems second semester. You have been warned.
Yeah.
But yes, there is Antivir, and if you are using Antivir, it's not too bad, although if you are running VMware products, there are known incompatibilities with Antivir and VMware, things like you may not be able to boot virtual machines if you are running Antivir, so just be aware of that one.
Oh, yeah, sure.
No, I just saw that on the release notes yesterday and thought I'd flag that one. If you're not running VMware, the last one for you for today... Bitdefender. Yeah, that's the one that everybody was saying good things about. Yep, go ahead, Sermon. The last one from you for today, apparently.
No, sir. I just want to know few softwares which can scan for my open and closed ports. How do I find whether the port is open on my network or closed?
That can actually be done with an application called Shields Up, which is located on www.grc.com. Check your chat window, Sermon. I've already typed it in. Okay, Malwarebytes, it's good. There was something that came up about that the other day that was problematic, and I can't remember what it was. Okay, you've had problems with it, have you? Yeah. Okay. Just be aware that a lot of the problems that we're seeing, Alex won't, because he can still look at his screen. But a lot of these things are inaccessible to us and very difficult for a totally blind person to use.
Yeah, I found that a difficult one to utilise.
Did you get that URL, Suman, by the way, for grc.com?
Yeah, I got it. Thank you very much.
Make sure you read the frequently asked questions and the documentation carefully before you start coming back next week and going, why does it show that I have 27,000 passive ports? Okay, so very important to read the frequently asked question on Shields Up. They're only as good as the scans that they actually do. The other thing you should probably do, and I'd highly recommend people go and grab a few of them, there is a podcast that's done with Steve Gibson and Leo Laporte from Tech TV in the States, and they're called Security Now, and they're really good podcasts to have a listen to. They teach you all about home security and NAT routers and Hamachi and all of those things. Okay, does anybody have any other questions or issues or anything they would like to raise before the lecture finishes? Tomorrow we're going to talk about netbooks. Netbooks, which are little notebooks, or sub-notebooks. They're smaller than notebooks. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. Now, the other tablets? Thing to mention... no, we're not talking about tablet PCs because they're inaccessible to us anyway. Well, to me and that. So we're talking about netbooks. I don't know what we're going to come up with, but we might come up with a prize for the person who does the best in discovery. You will get a prize. Last year, it was a wireless USB dongle. So who knows what it'll be this year. Here's a little bit of incentive for you all to work even harder. We're going to give the best person a prize at the end of discovery. Yes? No, seriously, what did you want to say? You just typed your name in three times. You're trying to get the prize. No, you can't get the prize by typing your name lots of times into chat. It doesn't work like that. You've got to do really well at the course. No, it's not going to be a lump of coal. It'll probably be something pretty small. It'll be something that I've dragged out of my parts bin that's sort of still vaguely useful, and we'll send it across to you, and you get a prize. I don't know whether there'll be a prize for local and one for each of the academies, or whether there'll just be one for an academy. But there will be a prize. Yes, free stuff. Okay, any pending things before I shut down for... We shut down for the day and go and have some morning tea, which won't include sponge cake, sadly, but we can't have everything. Minister at 1:30. Yes, I have. Minister at 1:30, if anybody's up. All right, everyone, have a good week. If you've got any questions, email them to caviinstructors@gots.net or email to the mailing list. I haven't sent too many of you posting to the Discuss mailing list. That mailing list is there for you. It's so that you can all help each other out and get answers to your questions. It is not if you have any questions, and you can discuss various things on the Discuss mailing list, such as firewalls and ports and... which antivirus does everybody like? And you'll get all sorts of responses from people that you've never even heard of who are in last year's class that are still on the Discuss list and happy to help out current students. So cavidiscuss@gots.net is the email list you want to be using if you have general questions. Although we do not do personal computer tech support on those lists unless there's a special arrangement because, well, we don't get paid for that, so... handy list, and definitely use it to communicate. Have a good week, everybody, and anybody who wants to show up tomorrow for the Thursday chat, we will be talking about netbooks.
Bye, everyone. Bye, everyone.
See you later, Geraldine, and goodbye all.